Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
It's been 1 year since the chaotic images of Kabul airport filled TV screens around the world when thousands of desperate Afghans tried to flee the country as the Taliban took control 2 decades after being removed from power by a US-led military coalition. So how has the country changed since then? And what is life like for the millions of displaced Afghans around the world? In a moment, I'll speak to journalist and columnist with Foreign Policy magazine Lynn O'Donnell. But first, I'm joined on the line by Gezu Yari, who is a project director with Afghan Voices of Hope. Gezu, you talked to us on this programme last October from a refugee camp in Poland. You'd fled Afghanistan at that time and you're now in the United States. Bring us up to date about what's been happening.
Thank you for having me. I mean, there is a lot happening. It depends on what is happening with me as a person, what has been happening in Afghanistan since last October. And also, you know, what has been going on with the people who are dispersed in different countries around the world. We see what is happening in Afghanistan, unfortunately. Things are not going very well and chaotic, stressful for all of us, especially human rights defenders across the world and women's rights defenders. And also, for me, I was evacuated to Poland last I talked to you. Then I came to the United States with my partner. Unfortunately, I couldn't bring my family with me. They are still somewhere in Poland. Some are still in other third world countries. And I wouldn't be able to get them here. That is a long process and very stressful.
It's a very difficult situation. I know you had previously lived in the United States, hadn't you?
I did. But this time, I don't think it mattered that I lived in the United States before, but I wasn't prepared to come to the United States and live. I never invested my time in the U.S. I never invested to have, you know, even a house, to have, you know, a cup, a plate, or, you know, or a blanket to be here. I had to start it from zero, as so many others who just were forced to be in exile and live in the United States, unfortunately.
So you said your family is dotted around the world now. It was very difficult for your mother to leave Afghanistan. Where is she now?
She is in a third world country, which I cannot mention the name because she is not, I feel like she is not safe. And she, it was extremely hard for her to leave. I remember in 2015 when I returned to Afghanistan, I told her that I'm going to sponsor her. I want her to come to the United States because she's not feeling well. And she just laughed at me. She said she doesn't want to leave Afghanistan. And none of my family members left Afghanistan. And that is why I returned to them instead of them coming to me. This time, I think because a lot of us left to different countries and she just felt like she couldn't do it by herself there anymore. And my older brother, who is living with her, and my mother was very worried about him and worried that something will happen to him and we were not around to support. And she just had to decide to leave the country, which I think was extremely heavy for her and for the whole family.
Very, very difficult. Now, you're still working on a project where you're collecting stories from Afghans who have left the country, which is a very important and worthwhile piece of work. But I'm sure it's really difficult for you to do that.
It is. I mean, I am full of stories. I am full of stories and experiences and personal narratives from people who are evacuated to France, to Canada, to the United States, to Poland. I unfortunately couldn't go to other countries such as Pakistan or Turkey to at least talk to those who just were smuggled to cross the borders. But I only talked to at least more than 250 people, close to 300 people in these countries. These stories are worth listening, but unfortunately it's so heavy and devastating that I feel like it has been destroying me in the past year. Yes, we have, you know, we lost the country. We lost what we have gained in the past 20 years. But, I mean, these stories are the reality of what we have actually lost. I have talked to a soldier, talked to a nurse, talked to a doctor, talked to a mother, talked to a father, talked to to so many people from different layers of the society. Talk to a taxi driver. I don't even have the courage to go back to these stories and listen to them and analyze them because they're really heavy. They're emotional. I remember I was in France. I went to Lyon and I sat with someone and we cried for hours. I remember I talked to someone in Poland in a refugee camp. I sat with them. I talked about 50 people in Poland in three refugee camps. I sat with them. We cried for hours and hours. And I think all of these stories are very emotional. And that is all of the voices that I collected are telling us what we have lost in the country. And I think historically that is really important to keep that, because for the next generation, if they are going to listen or something will happen in Afghanistan and we return these stories back to Afghanistan, the next generation will know that we paid a price and that price was very heavy on us. And we were not comfortable living in this country.
And I think people perhaps don't understand the burden of that price, because there is a belief, isn't there, that once you are safe in another country, be it the United States or France or Poland, as you have mentioned, that you then just pick up with your life and that you continue on and that you are safe. But that's not the case, is it?
This is so bizarre. I have talked to so many people. I do have so many friends who are in Ireland and UK and friends here in the United States. And that is the assumption, unfortunately, but it's not. I think I remember from the day that I left Afghanistan and up to now, there isn't a single moment that my mind would be in peace and free. I don't think, yes, physically we are protected. Physically, Afghans are not going through what others are going through in Afghanistan. But emotionally and mentally, people are not okay and they can't cope with the situation easily. One, you have to resettle in a new country with a new language, with a new system. Second, you're still grieving for what you have lost in the country. It is not that you had a choice. I don't think any of these Afghans left Afghanistan by choice, but they left by force. I don't know how to explain it. It's extremely hard for me. I hope that I do have a website that's called Afghan Voices of Hope. I just put 5 stories. I have more to come, but people just need to take their time, listen to these stories, listen to these voices. They are not edited. They are not polished. They are very organic and primary data. If people listen to these stories, you know, and the nervousness in people's voice and how they explain everything, they will understand how heavy it is for all of us to live in these countries.
I know you've stayed in contact with some women who are still in Afghanistan. What are they telling you?
People in Afghanistan, I think they are the fighters. I think you just follow in the news how they fight the Taliban on the streets. But the people who I'm in contact are the one who used to work with me, who used to work for the civil service of Afghanistan. They're mentally very stressed and lost because they don't have their jobs anymore and they can't go to work anymore. And most of these women that I'm in contact to are, you know, the leader in their houses. They don't have husbands or brothers, anyone who would just help them financially, but they had to help them themselves in the past years in Afghanistan. These days, they don't know what to do. I think they're lost. They're just looking for any opportunity that would help them to survive. I mean, they are fighting for they're fighting to survive, but they're not fighting to have, you know, a peaceful life. And everything is just dispersed in Afghanistan and things are going to very wrong direction and women are suffering the most, even more than how they suffered in 4 years back in the 1996.
Kezia, thank you for talking to us and we'll keep in touch with you and we wish you well in the United States. Thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm also joined on the line by journalist and columnist with Foreign Policy magazine, Lynn O'Donnell, who recently returned from Afghanistan. Lynn, thank you for joining us. Gezu's story, which we heard there, is certainly not unique. And what she describes, the hurt and the pain, that's something that's felt by Afghans who are all over the world.
They are all over the world. You're absolutely right. The grief and the depression and the confusion, it's running deep and it's not going away. It's probably exacerbated over the past week because of the one-year anniversary of the fall of the country to the Taliban. And the regular monitoring of the situation there by human rights organisations in particular, that are, you know, they're coming out with serious transgressions of human rights, arbitrary detentions, killings, torture. There isn't the security, there's no rule of law, and the Taliban are getting away with it, frankly.
You've borne extraordinary witness to the changes that have happened in Afghanistan. You were one of the only foreign correspondents there in 2001 when the Americans arrived. You were one of the only ones left when the Americans left last August, and you've been back since. So you have witnessed extraordinary change.
I have. I think that's fair to say, Claire. But what happened to me when I went back last month, which I did because I hadn't been there for a year and I wanted to see for myself what the situation is, I was detained by the Taliban. I was. They threatened to have me killed. They interrogated me. They abused me. They told me that I make up all my stories. My sources don't exist. And they forced me to make false confessions to that effect. It was pretty extraordinary. But what they did in by treating me in that way was give me a global platform, really, to talk about just what they are like. There is no authority except what comes through violence. They, you know, they have no credibility, no capacity to rule, and they're not ruling because they're not able. It's a prejudicial and violent regime.
And that must have been a terrifying experience for you, but for ordinary Afghans who are still there, they're in a desperate situation. I know some aid organisations are continuing to work, but can you describe the conditions there for many people?
Yeah, it is pretty awful. It was never a bed of roses beforehand. Afghanistan was the poorest country in the world, its government amongst the most corrupt anyway. Poverty was at 85% of the population, and every year the UN agencies were warning that people were facing starvation as into winter. It's probably gone up to 95% of the population, so it is much worse. But the Taliban are pilfering international aid and distributing it to themselves to their own supporters. And they're able to do this by ensuring that what comes in through the United Nations has then to be distributed to locally registered NGOs that are approved only by the Taliban. So this gives them hands free to basically take what they want from it. And that means that a lot of people are being bypassed and are missing out on life-saving aid. And how bad is it? People are being forced to sell children and body parts so that they can get money to buy food to feed their families. And it's only going to get worse because those people who had things that they could sell, like jewellery or kitchenware or let's face it, children, coming into the Himalayan winter that's approaching, now have nothing left. And so even people who've managed to get through will be facing a pretty dire situation. It's only going to get worse. And really, for a lot of people, it's difficult to imagine how much worse it could get.
It's horrendous to hear you describe it. What can be done, given that you've been there so recently, what can be done, Lynn, to penalise the Taliban to improve the situation for people who are living there under their rule?
Well, aside from a bit of imagination in delivering aid to people, why does it all have to go through the United Nations, which takes, you know, 30% off the top in overheads to start with? Why isn't there another way of delivering aid directly to people? There are small indigenous charities that do this using a Havala system, and they're able to get food directly to families and communities. There's one way that could be explored. But the other thing that's going on at the moment is that the United Nations Security Council is considering exemptions to travel bans on listed terrorists. There's about 40-odd leaders of the Taliban who are listed officially as terrorists. And what that has meant for many years already is that they can't travel internationally and they can't have access to any financial assets, and that there's an embargo on weapons being traded to them as well. Now, the travel bans were exempted so that these guys could travel for the so-called peace process that didn't exactly bring peace. And there is a pressure from China and Russia to enable these exemptions to continue, which would mean that these guys can still travel, often on private jets, to wherever they want to go to make deals with the governments of China and Russia, for instance, to exploit the country's mineral assets. This is the only tool in the box that the international community has to put pressure on the Taliban and show them that there are consequences for their actions. Okay. And that's happening today and tomorrow.
Lynn, many thanks for joining us. Lynn O'Donnell, journalist and columnist with Foreign Policy magazine.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.